The internet's full of true crime podcasts. More and more are added to the list every day. Figuring out where to start or where to go next can be overwhelming. But have no fear, I'm here to help. I'm Bob Ruff, and this is the place to find your next true crime binge. I'm joined today by Chelsea and Brittany of the Red Justice Podcast. Chelsea, Brittany, how are you guys doing today?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's my first interview since I've returned from CrimeCon. So we'll see if my brain has re-engaged from the no sleep in Vegas all week. So and Brittany, I hear you said you just came from Disney World. World or land?
Disney World. So I went to Universal for 2 days and then to Disney World for 3 days with my cousin and my niece and nephew. And so I just literally landed about an hour ago and then drove here. So,
oh, and Chelsea went ahead and booked you an interview for 60 yeah. minutes after you landed.
Yes. The airport. Yes, she did. I'm really thankful to her. But no, I'm very happy to be here with y'all today.
I mean, well, to be fair, time is of the essence. I'm due to give birth like any day now. So.
Yes.
I was just going to say, so I want to get to know you guys a little bit, and I'll start with you, Chelsea. And I saw in my notes that it says that you are currently pregnant and very close to your due date. And Erica wrote this like last week. I thought, well, that's a gamble. How close are we?
Yeah, next week. So we're like a week and a half away, but my daughter came a week early. So I was like, it could be any day now.
Right. So there's no, we're not taking 2 hours after you land, Brittany. We're going to be doing this immediately.
Right.
In case the baby got, you know what? If like you go into labor on the podcast, that'll be like, we'll make True Crime Binge history.
True.
You
know,
and anything for ratings these days.
Right. That'd be podcast gold.
And she's thinking about naming her baby Bob Ruff. So.
Oh, well, that makes a lot of sense. There's probably so many Bob Ruff babies out there.
Just one word.
So Chelsea, you have an online store called Scuffletown Suppliers, where you do candles and you both have online stores. So
yeah,
I guess. So did you guys meet in your online stores, or like what is your relationship with each other, and how is it that you both have stores?
Well, it's funny because those are actually other side hustles of us, because we both have real day jobs as well. But that is kind of how we met. We're both from the same tribe, from the same area, but we did not grow up together or anything like that. But Brittany actually was, I guess, a customer of mine is kind of how we met, and through social media. So,
yeah.
Nice. Did you guys like share the idea where you like, Brittany, you should also have it, because your online store is called what? Let me find it in my notes here. Or you could just tell me.
It's called Super Indian Apparel. And I actually had an idea of doing like a t-shirt company that was like super pro-native, pro-indigenous. And then Chelsea beat me to it. So the Chelsea store came out first. And we have kind of similar stuff, but also candles and board game. Really, you have puzzles and socks. And I mostly just do t-shirts. So hers is a lot cooler than mine.
Chelsea, all these things, the board games, are these all things that you make?
Yes, or make my husband make to his unfortunate demise, because he's also the editor of our podcast, unfortunately.
Yeah.
We wrangle him into everything.
His name's Dakota, correct?
Yes, Dakota.
Yeah, and so he just gets wrangled into all of your side hustles.
Yes.
So how does that cover? Is it like, hey, I've got this new idea for a way that I want to make some money, and then, by the way, you work for me now?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of how marriage works.
Isn't right? that what a husband right. is? That's what I was about to say. Yeah.
It's like a really, right. it's a more extensive honey-do list.
Yeah.
Right. It makes total sense. And your day job says you're an analyst for an investment management firm. What does an analyst for an investment management firm do?
So I work for an international investment advisor, mostly on doing client service relationship building. For a company, it's based here in Raleigh with offices in Switzerland too. So totally separate from anything podcast or apparel related.
Right. So your three jobs are all very different.
Yes, of course.
none of them intermingle. And so Brittany, So both of you are members of the Lumbee tribe, which I want to talk about a little bit. I want to know a little bit more about your tribe. But your background, so it says here that you graduated from UNC and Duke. Is it you just couldn't get into a good school? Or
oh, that's a good one. I'm actually at Duke right now, too, on Duke's campus, because that's where I work right now. But yeah, I went to Duke for undergrad. I went to UNC for my master's. And so I experienced the rivalry kind of on 10 since I was at both schools.
Right.
And even when I was here at Duke, I went to a Duke Carolina game in person and we won. And then when I went to Chapel Hill, I went to a Duke Carolina game in person and Duke lost. And I got cussed out because I was wearing a Duke shirt. So I really got the full experience right. at both schools.
So do your loyalties lie with Duke?
Oh, of course. That's the superior school. So of course.
Yeah, I see. Well, because you're a postdoctoral research associate.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, and I know what that means, but just for like anybody else, if you explain what that means.
I feel like most people don't know what it means. I'm always like, oh, yeah. So a postdoc is someone who has just finished their PhD and they're doing so that's literally means just postdoctoral program. And so typically you'll have this job for a year or two post PhD before you get a faculty appointment. And so in my role, I do research and my boss is actually Lumbee too. And so we do a lot of native focused research, but he's a hydrologist who studies water. And I'm an education expert. And so we kind of are merging our two interests together and examining the ways that environmental professionals make major decisions about native lands and native territories without knowing anything about native peoples. And I think similar themes are also found in our podcast as well.
Right. That's incredibly interesting. And so, and you said you finished your PhD, so you're actually Dr. Brittany Hunt?
Yes, but you don't have to call me that, though. Please don't, actually. Well,
good. I mean, I would, but I always slip up. So I'm glad you gave me permission to slip up and not. I do it every time I have Dr. Shiloh and Dr. Scott on. I keep calling them Shiloh and Scott. And then I feel, but people, someone always emails me and they're like, oh, that was very disrespectful.
Oh,
they're
my doctors. God. So, I don't feel like that at all. So please don't. Just call me Brittany.
Well, congratulations on your doctorate. And thank you for permission for me to forget to call you doctor.
thank you. Makes
things easier on me. And you co-authored a book called, now it's called, am I pronouncing it right? Is it Wozya People?
Not quite. It's Hoosia People. So, but good try. So it's a very Lumbee, like quintessential Lumbee phrase. And it's a phrase that, so you know how in American culture and Western culture, when you meet someone for the first time, you might ask them, what do they do for work? Or those are typically like the first questions you would ask someone. But in Lumbee culture, the first question that you would ask anyone, but particularly another Lumbee person, is who's your people? Because we want to identify who do you know who I know, who are you kin to, I'm kin to, and you're trying to establish kind of a connection to that person. Yeah, for sure. And so you would ask who's your people. And so you go. So then if a Lumbee person asked me, I would start with my grandparents and then I would go to my parents. And then if they didn't know them, I would tell them where I was from in Lumberton specifically, where I went to church. And so the book is about a little boy who is starting school for the first day in our tribal territory after living away for a while. And he's nervous about not knowing anyone. And then quickly he learns that he has a whole community to rely on and to back him up. And so he gets asked the who's your people question often throughout the book.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you're in North Carolina. Is that primarily where the Lumbee tribe resides?
Yes. Yeah, so we're mostly in Robeson County, North Carolina, which is in the southeastern part of the state, right on the South Carolina line.
Okay. So tell me about the Lumbee tribe.
Chelsea, do you want that one or me?
What isn't there to say? So the Lumbee tribe are technically the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River, about 60,000 members with a very, very complicated history, especially with the U.S. federal government. For example, we were federally recognized in 1956, but not entitled to the rights of most federally recognized tribes because we were recognized right during the termination era, where a lot of tribes were actually being stripped of their recognition rights. And so still, even this past year, there's a bill in Congress about retaining that full recognition status for the Lumbee people. So a very complicated relationship, as I mentioned, but very unique people. Dr. Melinda Maynor Lowry, who's also a Lumbee and a professor, calls us the original Southerners. And it's very true. You can probably hear Brittany and I's accent. if you go are ever curious about like the way Lumbee people talk and the way our accent is, if you Google Lumbee English on YouTube, there are several videos because we actually speak in a separate English dialect than other Southerners, where we know we could have our eyes closed and be in a room with 1,000 people from the South. But if we hear one Lumbee speaking English, we know that that person's Lumbee just by the way they speak. So our accent isn't just Southern, it's actually a dialect of Lumbee English. So really unique people, like I said, also kind of quintessentially Southern in many ways as well. And, you know, we're kind of, I don't want to say the leftovers of several tribal nations that were in Virginia and North Carolina and South Carolina, but, you know, our historical tribes are made up of many different ancestors as well from tribes in the South, because where we're from in Robeson County is mostly swampland. And so it was a great place to hide out. You know, settlers did not know how to navigate the swamps like we did. They did not know how to farm it and irrigate it in the way that we did. So for a long time, we were protected, which is why there's so many of us today.
You said there's 60,000 members of the Lumbee tribe. Wow.
Whole lot of people.
Yeah. And primarily, you said, located in the one, is it, did you say Robeson County?
Robeson County.
Wow. That's so... So tell me about the podcast. So the Red Justice Project is a COVID podcast. It looks like, as many that we've spoken to are, you guys launched in November of 2020. Did COVID have anything to do with the launch of your podcast?
We actually had the idea before COVID, and we were kind of procrastinating, I guess, because of our many different roles that we have. So we actually had a different name of our podcast. It was going to be called Stolen. And then by the time we got ready to launch, someone else already had that name. So we had to change the name of our podcast, which I actually like our name now better. But it was actually Chelsea's idea. She listens to true crime podcasts a lot and pretty avidly. And so she brought me into the world of listening to podcasts through her idea of us hosting an Indigenous true crime podcast. And so I started by listening to Serial, which then led me to you. Which then led me to a whole host of other true crime podcasts. And I think one of the most common themes that we notice throughout these is this obsession oftentimes with certain kinds of victims who are almost never Native American people or Indigenous women, even though Indigenous women are 10 times more likely to be murdered or go missing in various parts of the country, and definitely in Robeson County where we're from, which has a higher violent crime rate than Chicago and New York, even though it's a pretty rural county in North Carolina. And so very regularly we're hearing about murders in our county. Just last week there was 4 in a row. A body was just dug up last week, and now they've identified who the person is. And so there are all these different crimes that are happening very routinely where we're from and in Indigenous communities all across the nation, but there's very little media coverage. And so we wanted to exist kind of in that gap.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that you guys are doing that, because, you know, a lot of, and I'll admit, I'm one of them. A lot of the missing and murdered Indigenous women cases started to come to light after the Gabby Petito case, which, you know, made national headlines. It's interesting that, you know, a white girl that goes missing and then is later found is what seemed to finally point people, get people to take a look. And it was because there were activists that were, you know, up in arms saying, hey, why does this one person get all this attention? Look at the numbers of Indigenous women that are abducted and have gone missing and have been murdered, and no one's paying attention. As a matter of fact, I would love your take on this. I mean, I've determined I don't really have the time to do everything I want to do, but, you know, you guys are doing it, and you're part of the tribe, which is amazing. And the podcast, the episodes that I've listened to that you guys have put out are just incredible in the depth that you go into. What do you feel as to you know, women from an Indigenous tribe, from the Lumbee tribe, how do you feel about non-Indigenous people telling these stories? Because I'll preface that by telling you, when I started to learn about this, the part of me that inside of me that is like, oh my God, I want to make a difference, I want to help. My first instinct was, I can use my voice to tell some of these stories to try to help the cause. And I always got mixed messaging from people saying, you know, some people were like, that's great, do it. And then other people were like, you as a white man shouldn't be telling these stories. Do you guys have a feeling one way or the other on that? Because it's something that I'm just genuinely curious about, because it kind of took me aback. I was like, but I'm trying to help. But then I also understand the other side of that. How do you guys feel about non-native people telling the stories, investigating, and you know, and broadcasting these stories?
I think for me, that white allyship is really critical in amplifying what's happening to Indigenous women across the nation. There are a lot of white podcasters who are very prominent and popular, just like you, or like Ashley Flowers and Britt from Crime Junkie, or so many other podcasts that I can name. And you all provide a different level of visibility that Chelsea and I can't provide at this time. And hopefully we will be able to do that at some point. But I think that, again, white allyship is going to be really, really critical on this issue. And when white podcasters begin to cover these cases, they do typically make mainstream media more often. So I think that it's necessary for all people, but particularly white people, honestly, to be more engaged in around this topic and more interested. Because, for example, when JonBenet happened, I remember that vividly, and it really bothered me and still bothers me today. And I would like love to know what happened to JonBenet. Same with Natalie Holloway or Holly Bobo. There are all these cases that I think about and research, but I don't feel like the average American takes that time to do that same kind of deep dive into cases of Indigenous women, or the average American person doesn't really care about what's happened to Faith Hedgepeth or to Marcy Blanks or to Lisa Holman, different cases that we've covered on our podcast.
Right. What do you think, Chelsea?
Yeah, so I completely agree with Brittany. And we created our podcast not for Indigenous people, even though the bulk of our listeners are Indigenous people. We created it for the Bob Ruffs of the world, for people who are interested in true crime, who are not part of an Indigenous community, but want to learn more, want to know what they can do. Like, we created our podcast for you to say, hey, this is happening. Help us share the story. Help us tell the story. We are telling you what's going on. You know, we really do need any and all people who will get these stories out here, because, you know, as Brittany mentioned, the statistics are really alarming for the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women and men in the United States. Like, and the numbers are actually really deflated from what you see. Any kind of research that you might have did before the show to see how many thousands are missing, they don't always encompass fully the true number. Like, for example, I said the Lumbee have a really complicated relationship with the U.S. government. We're not counted in federal statistics of missing and murdered Indigenous women. So when we cover like Marcy Blanks, who, you know, we might talk about today, she's not counted in federal statistics for missing and murdered Indigenous women, even though she's an Indigenous woman. If Brittany and I were to go missing or murdered tomorrow, we would not be counted in federal statistics because of our tribe's relationship with the federal government. So we need people who are going to let other people know that it's complicated. And so while you, you know, we want you to amplify your voice and tell people, it's also hard to know that, like, hard to explain also the nuances of Indigenous relationships with the federal government too, right? Because you don't know all of those things.
Yeah, and I understand there's also that there's some challenges too for people that are not part of the tribe to even get people to speak to them, and especially particular some tribes. But that's, I'm glad to hear you say that, and I'm always, it's, you know, it sometimes probably should be an off-air conversation, but I like everybody to hear everything we're doing, because I always have these complicated responses. And frankly, it's always white people telling me how not to offend some other community. Right. And so if I get an opportunity to speak with someone from that community personally, you know, I kind of echo from my perspective what you both were saying, which is, if I have a big voice and a big platform and I can use it to draw attention to this, then, you know, I want to be able to do that, and I want to be able to help. So and hopefully this will, you guys coming on here will put a lot more ears on the work you guys are doing, because it's incredible work. You've already, you just launched in November of 2020. You've already done over 30 episodes. You've done two seasons, and your second season just started last month, right? Just in April.
Last week, actually.
Yeah.
Last week. Yeah. So you've got one episode out for season two so far?
Two.
Yeah. Two, yeah, as of yesterday.
Great. And so by the time this airs, people, there'll be several for you to catch up on. the case I want, and I guess tell me about the podcast. I didn't even get into that. I mean, you guys cover, obviously, I think people would get from context, cases that are true crime stories from indigenous, you know, that involve indigenous people. So tell us the mission of the podcast and what you're trying to do.
I think our overall mission is to, again, amplify the stories that are often go untold in the media related to crimes against indigenous people. I know for so many of the families that we talk to for our cases, they're frustrated and angry because they're not receiving justice in the courts, but then they're also not receiving justice in the media, and they feel like no one cared when their child was killed or when their sister was killed. And so I think for me, my personal mission is to stand in that gap and to show them that we definitely care, and that the communities who, or the folks who listen to us, will also care as well. And I think providing that kind of acknowledgement of families' pain is a part of our mission and my personal mission as well.
And we've seen in so many other places in the criminal justice system how attention does make changes. Even, you know, I work in primarily in wrongful convictions, and we're seeing, like, you know, I'm hearing stories of police officers and prosecutors, you know, when they're training and learning and teaching other, kind of passing the baton on to other people, telling them, do your job, like some podcaster is going to put it all over the internet because someone probably will.
Right.
So just the fact that all of a sudden there's eyes and ears on what they're doing has changed behaviors. And I think that if we can put more eyes and ears on the fact that so many indigenous peoples are being murdered and kidnapped, then they'll be, hopefully it would make them less of a target, because it seems like it's almost an easy target because nobody ever seems to care. The case we're about to talk about today is a prime example of that. Marcy Blanks, this crime, and I'll let you guys break it down for us. It's awful. And it's the type of crime that if this was a white woman, I believe we would have seen it all over the national news. And yet I had never, this is your, it was your episode 11, when you guys covered this case, until I listened to that, I had never even heard of this case before, which is tragic. So, I guess that's a good transition to move into, the case of the murder of Marcy Blank. So I'll let you guys kind of share her story.
Yeah. So another part of our, podcast that I think is different from others is that in some of the cases that we cover, we knew the victims. And so that's the case here with Marcy. So I used to work as a school social worker. So when I went to UNC, I got my master's in social work. And then after I graduated, I worked at a high school, and that's where I met Marcy. I worked there for a year, and I mostly worked with ninth graders at that time. And Marcy was in the ninth grade. She was so beautiful. She was just funny. She was spunky. She did not care. She wouldn't let anybody mess with her. She had olive colored skin, curly hair. She was skinny as a rail, just a vivacious and very lively person. And so she would come visit me in my office pretty regularly. She did skip school a lot, so when she was there, she would come see me. And I grew to really love her as a person over the time that I worked with her. And I met her mother during that time as well. And school social work was not for me as a profession. Social work is very difficult and grueling work, just with the things that you have to hear about. And so I took another job after my first year working there. And then about a year into that job, I was with a friend in his car, and it was at night. And I got a text message, and the text said that Marcy had been murdered. And the person told me that she had been murdered by her boyfriend, which I later found out was not the case. And it was in November of 2016, so it's almost 6 years ago now. And I remember at the time, I wasn't as obsessed with true crime, but I knew Marcy. And so this is one of the first examples of a person who I knew well who was killed. And so I remember looking up her story online and not finding a lot at the time. And then whenever Chelsea and I decided to do the podcast, I knew for sure she was one of the cases that I wanted to definitely cover. And that case, I think, marks a different era in our podcast, because that's where we begin to really heavily rely on family interviews And so the interview mm-hmm. with her mother, for the folks out there who will listen to the episode afterwards, is one of the most heart-wrenching ones that I think that we've ever done. I mean, to bear witness to a mother's pain when discussing something that should never happen to a mother in the first place. You know, it's unnatural in the scheme of nature for a parent to lose a child, but especially in the way that she lost Marcy. And so to hear the way that she talks about Marcy and the way that she talks about what happens was really chilling. So it was early in the morning on November 16th, 2016, and I believe Marcy was asleep. They lived in a small community right outside of Lumberton. Her mom had just left to go work, and I believe her mom works at a place called Smithfield, which is a chicken plant back home in Robeson County, which is where a lot of people work. And she had left early in the morning, I think around 4 or 5 or so. She had to go take Marcy's brother, who's special needs, to whoever the person is who keeps him while she works. And then she got a phone call about 45 minutes later. I can't remember if she had made it to work yet or not, but they said she needed to hurry up and get back home. And she thought that that something had happened to Marcy, but she thought that Marcy was okay. But whenever her mom got back to where they live, she found out that Marcy had been stabbed and that the house had been set on fire. And so later on, she goes to the hospital to see Marcy, and they won't allow her. They wouldn't allow her to touch her. And that's the part of the interview that really just, it was so difficult to listen to, because she said, as a mother, she felt like if she could just touch her, then she could bring her back. And I think that a lot of mothers feel these strong instincts for their children that are beyond reason and that are, I don't know, otherworldly or supernatural or primitive in a way that where we feel that you can just do something. She felt like she could touch her and bring her back. But since Marcy had been stabbed, technically her body was considered a crime scene. And so they wouldn't allow her to touch her baby. And so that was just the worst part of the interview personally. But she later found
it. I don't want to interrupt. Not only was that part, I mean, it definitely broke me down listening to it.
Yeah.
Also, I do want to point out, because I don't think we've mentioned this, that Marcy was 18, right, when this mm-hmm. happened.
She was just 18.
Just a teenager.
Just a teenager. Right. Just a teenager. So only 18 years old, probably 105 pounds soaking wet too. And so later on, as the day goes on, Miss Mary learned, Mary is Marcy's mom. And Marcy was actually named after her mother, who's named Mary, and then her grandmother, who was named Macy. So she put together the two and made Marcy. But she later found out that that Marcy had been stabbed 89 times, which is honestly more times than I've heard of anyone being stabbed. In all of the work we've done on our podcast, I haven't heard of anyone being stabbed that many times. She found out that Marcy had also been raped. Marcy had just gotten fake fingernails put on, and they were all ripped off where she was trying to fight her attacker. She also soon learned that her attacker was a young man named Edward Wright, and I guess we'll say alleged attacker at this time because he still hasn't been brought to trial, but he is in police custody. But she had been raped, stabbed 89 times, and then he also set the house on fire. So since Marcy's brother is special needs, they had a special lock on the door of the house where they could lock it from the inside at night so that he wouldn't wander out, because he wanders out sometimes. And so the guy, Edward, actually had tried to lock the door. He tried to lock Marcy into the house and take the key after he set it on fire, but he wasn't able to. And so he fled. And then Marcy, through some miracle, was able to leave the house after being stabbed that many times and burned again and raped. And she was able to leave the house and walk to the neighbors or crawl to the neighbor's house, and who was a police officer. And she told him who had stabbed her. And then, unfortunately, she passed away on his doorstep. And so then she was taken to the hospital later, where her mother went to view her body.
To me, that is the most incredible part of this story, is what a strong, strong young woman she was. Like you said, she was small, 105 pounds. She had been beaten, raped, and stabbed 89 times, and still found the courage and the strength to get up and find her own justice in a way that she may managed to make it far enough to get to someone who happened to be a police officer and told him exactly who did this to her before she passed away. It's just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never heard of anything like this in my life. And I listen to Dateline every week. I listen to Crime Junkie every week. I listen to Snapped everything. I listen to your podcast. And I have never heard of anything like this. The only thing close to it is a case I heard on the Oxygen Network of Jessica Chambers. And I'm not sure if she was stabbed, but she was maybe, I don't know how they killed her, but she lived long enough to tell what happened to her. And she was set on fire as well. She lived long enough to say that it was either Derek or Eric who had done it. They couldn't really hear her very well. And then she passed away. And then Oxygen, I think, did an 8-part special on her case.
Yeah.
And so just comparing that case to Marcy, who I think got 4 articles in our local newspaper. Yeah, because her name is Marcey, and they would take the E out. And so just to know that something like this disturbingly eerie and upsetting story got so little local coverage, let alone getting any, no national coverage or anything like that is I think really upsetting. And it was also really upsetting for her mother too.
Right. And I want to, as we wrap this up, I don't often do that. I always tell you guys to check a show out and it could be your next big true crime binge, but really these stories are important. The stories they're telling are incredibly important. You hear from family members. I'm going to ask all of you to go give an episode. This is episode 11. Marcy Blank's story. There's over 30 stories for you to listen to. Give them a listen, share them on social media, and help be a part of bringing these stories into the public view, because it's the only way we're ever going to make a difference is if we're able to make people aware of what's going on. And with that being said, I want to thank both of you. Their names are Chelsea and Brittany, and the podcast is called The Red Justice Project. Check it out, please, and give every one of these stories a share if you can. Ladies, thank you so much for taking the time to join me, especially after just getting off of an airplane.
Of course. Thank you so much for having us.
True Crime Binge is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Audioboom. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing. Music and artwork by Shane Yoder of PutThemInASong.com. Our website, TrueCrimeBinge.com, was created by Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com. If you're a listener and would like to recommend a future guest or a podcaster that would like to request an interview, you can do so right on our website. And again, that web address is TrueCrimeBinge.com. If you're enjoying the show, please do me a huge favor and take a minute to rate and review us on iTunes or whatever platform you're using to listen. And make sure you give us a follow on social media. We can be found everywhere at True Crime Binge. Thank you so much for listening, and make sure you tune in next Wednesday morning for another podcaster, another case, and another True Crime Binge.